This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Casting Long Shadows, How Horror Influences Other Genres. And this week we are very pleased to welcome Claire Waller, who is the author of the very clever, funny and slightly contentious young adult novel Fugly, and under her alter ego is also the author of Creature Feature, Predator X and the Lovecraftian flavoured Nine Eyes.
Hi Claire!
Hello! Hello there!
Hi!
Hi!
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So this is one of those weird things where I know Claire via Twitter because we've been talking on Twitter for quite a while, but this is actually the first time that we've actually had a conversation.
I know, it's always these slightly awkward things of, oh my god, they're real people. Yo, I did sit there and think, oh gosh, what if they've got really difficult accents? I'm not very good at that. You know, I used to have a boss who was very, very broad Glaswegian, and I loved her to bits, but...
You needed translation software in your head
somewhere. I do somewhere. I'm terrible. I'm sorry. But that's okay. That's all right. I was having these worries thinking, oh, crikey, am I going to make a complete fool? And I think I probably already have. Never mind.
You're fine. You're absolutely fine.
Okay. So, I mean, Claire, obviously, our listeners don't know who Claire is, probably, unless you've read her books. But she is, like, the... Don't take this the wrong way. But she is the person I think of when I think of the horror genre. Which... now I've said that out loud, sounds even worse than it did in my head. But
no, I take that as a compliment because, you know, it's important. It's important to me and it features a lot in my life. You know, I mean, that kind of vaguely disturbs people when I tell them that. But
you see,
it's true.
I passed that on to Alan and he was just like, no, this is really interesting. We should invite her over.
I'll come. I don't mind. Anything to get out of this house. I mean, I've been in here since March.
So anyway, Claire, it was something that I found when I read Fugly, which is a brilliant book, by the way, and obviously I'm going to get Claire to talk about it a little bit in a moment, is the fact that it has a strong element, it draws very strongly on horror, even though it's not a horror novel at all.
I know. It was one of those things, when I started writing it, it was like, okay, we're going to go down that avenue again, are we? Fine. Off we go then.
Follow that white rabbit. Yeah, so... Claire, could you tell us a little bit about yourself as a writer or, you know, whatever, and a bit about Fugly?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the obligatory, I've been writing all of my life, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I kind of started in fan fiction and stuff like that. Writing, shall we, Dungeons and Dragons fan fiction, because, you know, why not? And then... started branching off more into... I always had this really big this thing about horror. When I was a kid, I absolutely hated it. I was absolutely petrified of it. Anything that was slightly scary, I'd run in the opposite direction because my imagination would just twist it and twist it and twist it into something really, really quite awful. So I kind of avoided it all. And then I was sat down with my mum, who wasn't always brilliant at filtering what we should watch. And so, for example, she said she recorded this fantasy film. She said it was a fantasy film. And she said, it's a little bit like The Hobbit. And it was called The Sword and the Sorcerer. I don't know if you know that film.
That does ring a bell, vaguely.
Yeah, it's a terrible 80s fantasy film where people get their hearts ripped out and somebody else has his head ground against like a sword sharpening stone and like a grindstone. Yeah, it was quite horrifically violent. And I'm sat there, you know, sort of all of about 9 or 10 years old thinking, I am not going to sleep for a month, you know, and I didn't. And it was always that whole thing. And there was this one particular episode of, it was a show, I can't remember what it was called, but it had Leonard Nimoy in it. And he used to talk about sort of weird things. And I was always kind of vaguely into weird things anyway. You know, I was obsessed with the Loch Ness Monster as a child. And I was obsessed with, was God an astronaut and all that nonsense. And, you know, just anything that made my mind go poof, I really liked. And Mum was like, Leonard Nimoy, he's from Star Trek, this will be fine for the children. Yeah, apart from the fact that it was showing clips from Alien and it was showing clips from The Thing. And yeah, and not only that, it was the clip where it was the chest compression, you know, the defibrillator
scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, if you've seen The Thing, you'll know exactly what that is when he's doing the defibrillator on the chest and the chest opens up as a big mouth and then he bites his arms off. Now, I must have been about 9 and I had no context for this scene whatsoever. All I know was somebody's chest burst open and tried to eat somebody else. And again, I didn't sleep for ages. I used to have this thing where I used to listen to music before I went to bed because otherwise I would have, you know, my dreams would get too much. And to the point where Captain Sensible's Happy Talk, the song, petrified me because I didn't want my dreams to come true because they were too scary. So, yeah, as a child, horror was, I had this weird relationship. Then I probably got to about 12 and I started picking up, God knows why, but I started picking up Stephen King books and I started reading them. And then I must have been just sort of late 12, maybe 13, and my friend's brother lent me an album called Ride the Lightning by Metallica, and the last song on it is called I think it is called The Call of Cthulhu, I think. And I was like, what the hell's that? Now remember, this is, you know, like the very early 90s, so there's no internet, nothing like that, and so you can't just Google up who these people are. So it became like this real sort of mystery, like what the hell is this thing and why is it so interesting? And he lent me a copy of The Dunwich Horror, which was obviously the first Lovecraft story, yeah, I ever read. And that kind of hooked me, because all of a sudden horror wasn't just scary stuff, horror was mysterious stuff. And I'd always had this thing about mysteries and I'd always had this thing about weird stuff. And then I realised that actually it's not all about the blood and the gore and the horribleness like that. It's actually more about people and about trying to find out things and trying to discover things. And so after that, I started sort of getting more and more and more interested in it. And then one day, I think I was about 16, I got hold of a copy of my nemesis, The Thing. And I was like, do I really want to watch this? And you know what? I sat there and I watched it, and it absolutely petrified me the first time I watched it, because obviously it is a very scary film. But I absolutely loved it because I had that context now.
Yeah.
And what I loved about it was not so much the fact that it was a creature feature. It was the fact that it was the isolation, mm, and it was the mistrust between the men and that glorious, downbeat, ambiguous ending. Mm. And that was it for me. That was it. I'm just a sucker for an ambiguous ending now. And, you know, it's sort of like that whole, okay, so we've come to the end, but, you know, things could still go very, very wrong.
Yeah.
And I just love that. I love that question that it posed.
Yeah, see, I think Alan discovered, yeah, The Thing at about the same age and had exactly, yeah, the same reaction. So he obviously thinks about it the same as you. Whereas, yeah, I didn't see The Thing until I was in my 30s and it didn't have the same impact on me. Because
I imagine it probably didn't, yeah, no.
Because I think I'd discovered horror through slightly different pathways, and it always interests me how people sort of reach horror. Mm. But before we get on, yeah, to that, tell us a bit about, yeah, Fugly.
Sorry. Right, okay, Fugly. Fugly is an interesting book because I never actually intended to write it. It wasn't something I sat down and thought, yeah, I'm going to write it. Initially, there was going to be a book about, and this probably sounds a little bit more on brand for me, it was a book, it was originally, the original sort of idea it crystallised around was an unpopular girl decides to summon a demon to help her get her revenge on people. Which, is, yes, it's possibly a little bit more, yeah, what you'd expect of me. But it started off, I was out running one day, and I am not, shall we say, a delicate person. You know, I'm quite a hefty lass. But that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, go out and try and keep fit and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of misunderstandings and misinformation around about people who do exercise. You know, people think if you exercise, you're going to be beautiful and skinny and all this. And it's like, no, you can pound the streets for hours and hours and hours and end, and it won't do anything. But it does help your health.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there I was going out for a morning run. And as I was, and my headphones weren't working, so I didn't have any music. And as I ran up a road around the corner from me, a very pleasant young man on a scooter with no helmet, obviously, goes past me and then yells at the top of his voice, "Well, run then, you fat bitch."
Oh, dick.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was like, and the stupid thing was that I've had things like this said to me before. Yeah, people, I don't know what it is. They just seem to think that they can just say whatever they like because you're a stranger. And that you want to hear their opinions. And I think it was just one of those things where after years of, I remember being, years ago, I remember walking across Guildhall Square in Portsmouth, and some woman yelling out, "Ever heard of Slimfast, love?" which obviously also made it into the book. And I don't know, I actually I kind of went home feeling quite horrible. And I must admit, I did sit down and I did write this very self-pitying screed about it didn't matter how hard I tried. It didn't matter what I did. You know, people were still judging me just literally based on the fact that, you know, I'm not a size 12. And I was thinking, you know, there's so much more than just the size of their clothes. And so that's kind of where it started and where it started crystallizing. And then I kind of sat there and thought, yeah, you could play with this. And the other thing that I'd been dealing with at that point, not in direct relation to me, but with some of the kids I was teaching, was online bullying and online trolling. And from both sides of the fence, because on one side I'd had kids who were being trolled. And I also taught this very interesting young man who I could see, he wouldn't completely admit it to me, but I was thinking, yeah, you are on 4chan and I know you're trolling people. And I also knew that he was doing it to make himself feel better. And that's kind of like where that came from. It was this idea that I wanted Beth was a victim, but at the same time, you know, not everybody reacts to being a victim in the same way. And so when she started with the internet trolling, it really was just this whole thing of she just wanted to make herself feel better. And I knew that would be a controversial stance to take.
Yeah, I think it's sort of made it a bit of a Marmite book for people.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I know that.
I mean, just to recap for Madeline, who obviously hasn't read it, Beth is overweight 18-year-old who's going off to university but still living at home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's quite, I don't know, she's internalised everything bad that anyone has ever said about her, I think, is a fair thing to say. And she makes herself feel better by going online and taking people down as a troll.
Right. Yeah, basically, she goes onto Instagram, she goes onto the Pretty Girls pages, and it, at one point she says that initially, when she first went onto Instagram, she behaved in the way that, the socially acceptable way. She made nice comments and she was nice to people, and she said that she had a bad day and she made some vile comments, and it was the attention she received for making those vile comments made her realise that she would get more attention from being horrible than she would from being pleasant and being nice. And unfortunately, that is so often true in our society. I mean, you just have to look at our entertainment systems. You have to, look at the television. You know, everyone loves it when someone's cruel and gets taken down. Everyone loves it when someone fails.
Yeah, we are negatively biased, which means
we really are.
Yeah, we will weight things far more towards the negative. So someone says something nasty to you, it has more weight than a compliment. And
absolutely. And also, but then remember things like, you know, you look at the television that we watch, and you're looking at things like Britain's Got Talent and all that. Everyone wants to watch the ones where people get torn to pieces.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to watch the ones when people are cruel. I feel a little bit sort of hypocritical saying this, but everyone loves snark.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing about, oh my God, he's so snarky, he's so funny. And actually, when you actually go back and you think that, actually, no, he's just been vile.
Yeah.
It's just been really, really horrible. And we kind of celebrate that kind of, oh, the snarky, cool, detached edgelord type. And we do reward that kind of behavior by saying, oh, they're kind of cool. And that was, and Beth found that herself. You know, the minute she stopped being nice and started being sarky and started being sarcastic and started being unpleasant and started, you know, being edgelordy, all of a sudden she's getting attention. And a lot of people, especially if you've only been given negative attention, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of attention you get, whether it's positive or whether it's negative, you're still getting attention, and that is still a rush.
Mm. About to say that it's interesting because it's, you start off with Beth almost sort of pushing you away, even though she's the narrator of her own book.
Absolutely.
And then she pulls you in gradually, and you can't help starting to relate to her. But while you're relating to her, half the time you're horrified by what she's actually doing.
Exactly. And that's exactly it. It is that whole thing of she is incredibly vulnerable. Stupidly vulnerable, but at the same time, you know, she deliberately pushes people away. She deliberately she kind of wants to shut, because she almost, like, she wants to shut it down before she has a chance for anyone to actually judge the real her.
Yeah,
it's like it's like her protective shell that she puts around herself. And then obviously as things go on, she meets two people who are sort of almost on the same day, which prove pivotal for her and her development. And you've got Tori, who's the fellow troll, and then you've got Amy, who
she's an absolute precious little cinnamon roll. She's just so lovely.
She is a real sort of, she is such a little ray of sunshine. She really, really is. And when I was writing the book, the funny thing was, when I was writing the book, it was like Beth was like all the horrible, bitter little thoughts I'd ever had, you know. But Amy was my people pleaser. Amy was the person that I want, you know, that I want to present to people, yeah, if you like. And the funny thing also with Beth is that when people say about, oh, she's so mean, count the amount of times she actually says anything mean out loud.
Yeah, it's all internal.
It's all internal. She doesn't say anything. In fact, Amy comments on how quiet she is because it's all festering inside her. It's all either online or in her head. You know, she doesn't actually say anything unpleasant to anyone to their face.
I think that was a really interesting parallel to draw. The fact that, yeah, that there is definite horrific and psychological elements there. But the idea that people treat the internet as if it's an extension of their own thoughts. And therefore they think and say things they would never actually say out loud to people in person.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you see it every day.
I'm actually teaching a module all about publishing on the internet at the moment.
Yeah.
And one of the discussions we had was why people post these kinds of things on the internet. And a part of it is the psychology of not actually thinking that people on the internet are real. And it's not that we think, oh, they're not real. It's the fact that, you know, a huge amount of communication comes from the visual and the tonal and things like that, not simply words.
Exactly.
And when you can't see somebody, when you can't empathize with them, and empathy is a big part of, you know, what we do, when you can't do that, you suddenly find that the things that, you know, you might not have said are a lot easier to do. And I did an exercise with my class, and I always do this, and it's always really funny, where I said, okay, what I'd like you to do is I want you to look at the person next to you. I want you to look them dead in the eye. I want you to tell them that they're really ugly. And it's really funny because for the most part, most of my female students look at each other and they're like, no, we can't do it. And then I always have a couple of male students who just sort of whip their chairs around, look straight at each other and just go, man, you're hideous. Right into each other's faces. But they do it, like, and they're laughing and they're smiling. But they say, yeah, we could only do it because we knew that we were joking.
Yeah, exactly. And it is that whole thing of, it's okay, you've got that safety net that says, look, you know, dude, you know that I've been told to do this. You know, this isn't what I think. This is just something I've been told to say. It's fine.
It also means that you can see the impact of your words directly. Mm. So you know, for you, you might say, okay, so I told them that they were a bit ugly. And you just think, okay, all right, I could shake that off. That wouldn't make a difference to me. But you don't know what that person is going through, what their mood is at that particular time, whether it's something they just snort at and go, yeah, okay, or whether it's actually the final, you know, the final straw, and it triggers something worse. You don't know. And the problem is that if you do that in person, you tend to be able to see people's reactions and know if you've gone too far or know to sort of make it a joke or things like that. You can't do that on the internet.
No, and people don't. It's people build their own persona because you also start beginning to sort of project what you would want to be. And so you have this double whammy of you can't see the heartbreak in that person's eyes when you say something awful. You can't see the way that their body shrinks down when they say something terrible. You know, you can't see that. All you've got is a bunch of emojis, you know, and or memes, and you can hide behind this stuff, and you can and you can also say, yeah, it's just banter. I'm just being funny.
Yeah, you don't need to be so sensitive.
Yeah. Jinx.
Yeah, but also, and also, and there is also this whole thing, like I said, we hold these people up. We say, oh my God, they're so funny. They're so vicious. Oh, they're serving the tea. And you're like, okay. I mean, I personally have a rule now, which means when I read something and it makes me really angry, I just click out of it.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, I especially with what's been going on recently, you know, politically and with COVID and all that, if I read somebody saying something that I think is really stupid, I'm not going to even argue with you about that. I'm just going to click out of it because that is going to ruin my mental health, because I know that if I speak to you, you are going to say something that is going to stick with me and it's going to, you know, it's not going to be good for me. And I think that's the thing. You build that up. I remember when the internet first came around, I mean, God knows how old now, but I remember we were early adopters for the internet, and we had the internet in the late 90s, and I watched like the build up of social media, and I watched sort of like the interactions that people were having. And to begin with, again, yeah, I remember, God, who, I can't remember what book it was. I read a book and I didn't like it, and I said something really sarcastic about this book, and lots of people were like, oh my God, you're so funny, that's so funny, oh yeah, I totally agree with you. And then someone else turned around and said, you should have said you just didn't like it and left it at that. And then I thought, you know what, you're right.
Yeah,
you're 100% right. I could have just said, yeah, it wasn't for me.
And it's, I think it's where you go to do it as well. It's one thing to be sort of like, that's, I'm it. On a book review site, someone's asked me to review this book, this is my honest opinion, but I'm not gonna like throw it everywhere on the internet.
Exactly. And it was, I think I was on DeviantArt at the time, you know, so, and a long time ago, because I haven't been on DeviantArt for about 10, oh God, more than 10 years. And I just remember, and it's, and you know, you have these little moments where they, you can't remember the exact sort of thing, but you can remember just that, that one little bit that made you go, oh my God, yeah, that's actually very, very true.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought, actually, that is right. And then somebody wrote, I mean, obviously I've been writing for a long time. I used to write fan fiction. I've been posting up artwork for a long time online, and the vast majority of people are really lovely, but there are people out there who just love to tear people down. And some of the comments that you get are vicious, and they do affect you, whether you want to be, you know, oh, it doesn't bother me, water off ducks back or whatever. It does affect you. And I think with Beth, because obviously people have been saying things to her face, you know, I've been there, I've had, and it's always strangers. It's never people you know.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, it's always strangers. And you sit there and you think, I really shouldn't give a toss what you think, because I don't know you. You're just saying something because, you know, you're 19 and stupid. Yeah.
Anyway, it all goes quite, it goes in an interesting and quite dark direction, doesn't it? With Fugly.
Yes, it does. It gets very, very dark. Yeah, and obviously, because this is where, it's when the real life and the internet stuff starts colliding. Because obviously one of the people that she picks on, she doesn't realise that actually what she says has effect.
Yes.
You know, and then you get that horrible, I'm not going to spoil it, but you get the horrible scene when she actually realises the complete, what people are actually doing, and she realises, oh my God, okay, so every single time somebody logged off, or every single time somebody's account disappeared, maybe that wasn't just because I'd won.
Maybe you'd actually caused
maybe
this other
I've actually really hurt
chain
them.
Of events to happen.
Yeah. Maybe I've actually really hurt someone, and someone's, you know, done things that I don't really want to think
so,
about.
So Tying this to, we're going to go on to our main discussion now. By the way, guys, our discussion obviously is about horror today, and Madeline and I have forgotten to say Happy Halloween, because this is
Happy Halloween.
This is our Halloween episode, and we've just gone, oh, it's going to be episode, Halloween. We've got a guest, we've got the shiny new thing.
Yeah.
But every day is Halloween.
This is the final episode of our series leading up to this. For all those who are celebrating Samhain or Halloween, we hope you're having a really wonderful weekend, and that you have lots of spooky but fun happenings to look forward to. So yes, this is all really rather appropriate. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about horror.
I'm amusing myself with my own notes here, but basically, horror, we don't talk about it very much on this podcast, not because we're not fans, but perhaps it's, I don't know, we seem to go down the fantasy and science fiction rabbit holes a bit more often. So this is more appropriate for the season. So at its most basic level, as an objective, horror introduces you to fear. So why would you watch or read something which has the primary objective of making you feel fear? And I've said, let's take a look at the human brain. Obviously, I don't mean literally, but if you want to imagine that, please go ahead. We are the dissecting dragons, after all.
You never know.
Here we are.
Basically, horror is the genre that it cuts past all your higher and more sophisticated brain functions and goes straight for your amygdala, your lizard brain.
Which is why it's great. None of that nonsense. None of that higher thinking.
No, don't
nonsense.
Reason this. Don't forward plan anything.
Don't reason this. It doesn't matter. Don't think about it. You know it can't be real. But hey, just you know, let's just make you, you know, go wobbly.
Yeah, and that's what it does. It gives you it gives you an approximation of the fight, flight, or fright reaction. It gets your sympathetic nervous system going, and you produce adrenaline. Adrenaline has obviously lots of interesting effects. It picks your heart rate up, makes you breathe faster. It also makes all your senses more acute, so you feel more alive.
Yeah, this is why writing it's really hard.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm not kidding. You sit there and you're like, three paragraphs. No, I've got to stop now. It's time for a biscuit. It's time for a cup of tea.
And it's like,
why does this take you so long to write? Because I'm absolutely petrified. I scared myself. I'm sorry. I know I imagined it, but it's frightening in there.
And yeah, definitely. And the other half of the equation is obviously when you come down, it's like the roller coaster. When you come down and the ride is ending, when you get to the other side of the horror film or the other side of the really, really creepy book, you have this rush of endorphins which make you feel good and cleansed. And it's this entire rush of catharsis.
It's like, I've survived, even though I'm sat on my sofa and there was nothing in here in the first place. It doesn't matter. I'm still here. I'm alive. I'm a survivor. You know, it's that kind of thing. And the other thing with horror, I find, because a lot of my horror and a lot of my horror preferences are not just tied into just being scared. For example, I am not the person who will sit down with you and watch a torture porn film.
No.
I am not interested in someone tying someone up against a chair and pulling bits off them. No. That's not for me. What I want is your weird. As much as scary, I want to look at my screen or my page or whatever it is and just go, what the hell?
Yeah, it's the mind bendiness.
It's that, exactly. It's that exploration of this is not right. And I don't mean this is not right as in, like I say, people putting bits off each other, because no, I'm not interested in that. But it's that whole thing of the world, the universe, reality, whatever you want to call it, is far stranger and far more hostile than we ever would like to imagine. Yeah, we think we've got this safe little world that we live in, where in fact, you know, it's a lot stranger and it's a lot more dangerous than we give it credence to. You know, we have this sort of like this, we build this false bubble around ourselves.
Yeah, and it's,
you know,
it's bursting that bubble, isn't it? It's that eerie sense of possibility.
That's exactly it. That's exactly. I remember during lockdown. Obviously, I'm also a teacher, so I do a lot of stuff, and I was homeschooling my children, and they were asking me foolishly, because obviously I was writing as well at the same time, and they were going, "Mummy, what's your book about?" And I'm thinking, "Okay, how do I explain this?" And so I actually read them the story from Beyond, which is basically what the book I'm writing at the moment is kind of based on, that same kind of context. And they were fascinated by it. And at the end, my 9-year-old looked at me and went, "Mummy, are there really weird blobby things in the air that we can't see?" That will-? And I said, "I don't know, darling. Nobody actually knows." I said, "That was just the imagination." She went, "Well, I'd be a little bit worried about that because I don't really want to breathe them in." I was like, "Okay, well, keep breathing, darling, because you're okay." I said, "It's more just the idea that there might be something there that we cannot perceive and we cannot see or touch or feel or smell or whatever. But that doesn't mean it's not there." And then she looked very, very thoughtful. And she said, "Right, it's a little bit the way that dogs can hear things that we can't hear." And yeah. I thought, that's actually very clever.
Yeah.
You know, you're 9, well done. I'm quite impressed with that. And it is that whole thing of, yeah, we have, do you remember that? Years ago, there used to be a nature program called Super Sense.
I do remember that, yeah.
Do you remember that? Do you remember it had that weird sort of neon shapes of animals at the beginning? Yeah, I used to love that. And that was one of the things that got me interested in this, and this idea that there is more there than we could ever hope to perceive. And then you read like all the stuff in physics and stuff, and you're like, oh my God, you know, the world is just way stranger than we ever give it credit for. And, you know, literally anything could happen.
Yeah, definitely. You know?
And so there is that mixture of, it's that wanting to be frightened, but also it's that fear of the dark, but fear of the unknown as well.
Yeah. And,
you know,
it's quite interesting because in terms of horror, we have a history of that kind of content. So this is not a new phenomenon, which is part of a sort of a jaded world. Far from it. You know, you go back and you find scary stories and horror stories as far back as we have recordings of stories.
I was going to say, have you looked at any religion anywhere?
Yeah, absolutely.
You read the original text and you're like, oh my God. I mean, they literally just, I'm going to terrify you into doing as you're told.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's not just in terms of that. It's also in terms of entertainment and the kind of stories which are shared for entertainment. And horror as a genre is perceived to be new, because genres, in terms of what genres are a relatively new concept. But a lot of how we see horror and how it's shaped now is basically because horror was sort of born from the Gothic in terms of genre. And the Gothic, because the whole point of the Gothic, it was born out of this period of, I say it was born out of it, the most of what we see within the sort of the Gothic, we can blame the Victorians for. And it was born out of that question between the past and the future and human morality. And, you know, it's so mixed in with things like sci-fi and fantasy, which is why horror is such an interesting genre, because it has little touches of all of these different things. And yet the whole concept is that we want something which is going to frighten us.
It is funny, isn't it, how you can mix so many different genres together and you can still come out with horror at the end of the day. And sometimes that horror will come from a ghouly, ghosty, supernaturally sort of angle. You know, sometimes it is the fear of the unknown. Sometimes it will come from, you know, how many times have you read, it's got romance in it, and you're like, okay, that's actually really scary. Because you're thinking, you know, someone said to me once, you know, every night, you know, when you get married or you're with a partner or whatever, and you go to sleep, and it's like, how well do you really know that person?
Yeah.
How do you know they're not going to turn around and do something terrible to you in your sleep? Well, you don't.
Or thanks even for the that. The one I saw was Mira Grant's Newsflash series with Feed, and the thing was the idea of this Kellis Amberley virus, which gives people, you know, creates zombies effectively.
Yeah.
What would happen was you'd reach an amplification threshold with the virus, and the virus would just take over. So if you got bitten, then that was automatically over the amplification threshold. But if you died, you also had a dormant form of it, and when you died, it basically got released into your cells and took over. So you could go to sleep next to someone and wake up to find they died in their sleep and had come back and bitten you, kind of thing.
I know, it's great, isn't it? And the funny thing is that I mean, this probably won't come as a surprise to anyone, but we're talking about I used to have extreme nightmares as a child. And my family on my mother's side are basically the history of sleep disorders. And I do suffer from night terrors. And ooh, my husband, when he sleeps, we joke about the fact that he holds a pillow. But he holds a pillow as he sleeps because I do have a habit of, acting out my dreams. And there have been many times where he's just like, yeah, you were hitting me again last night. And it's like, I'm really sorry about that. He said, I don't know what you were on about. But yeah, the amount of times that I run out of bed and I've literally ripped the bed to bits because there are spiders in the bed. Yeah. And so he gets a sort of like a proper sort of front seat view of just what people can do in their sleep. So yeah, people can do these things in their sleep. But it's that, and I can't remember what I was going to say now.
It's an interesting little tangent, but let's go back to sort of the why horror thing and just round it off with...
Oh, that was right. Genre, horror in different genres is the fact that, yes, because there is horror in life all around us, it's going to infect. Yeah, our fear response is the thing that keeps us safe.
Yeah, definitely. Horror, obviously, functions as a safe way, if you like, to confront and learn to deal with fear.
Yes, absolutely. That, and it's fun.
I've also seen, I mean, I don't know what you guys think of this opinion, but I've also seen it put that horror sometimes presents a platform for you to act out your more negative emotions, so anger, frustration, jealousy, that instant desire you have to really punch someone in the face or strangle them.
That's the reason why I wrote Fugly. Let's face it. One thing when I was talking to my agent about it, and we did say, we said, the thing is that everyone has these negative, horrible, little nasty thoughts. Everyone has these thoughts in their head. Whether you would like to admit that you have this horrible, nasty, vicious, vindictive little side is another matter entirely. And that's, we were talking about how polarizing Fugly could be. And I think, we came up to the conclusion that some people are okay with facing that side of them. Other people just aren't.
Mm.
Yeah,
they're
agreed.
Just not ready. They're just not ready to face the fact that, we can be, every single one of us, a nasty, horrible, vindictive little beast.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why some people had that knee-jerk, oh God, I don't like this book reaction.
I don't like this, because it's making me feel uncomfortable. And it's like, welcome to horror, bitch.
Definitely.
So, and that's it. And I know it wasn't a horror novel, and I know it wasn't. But the elements, obviously, there's still the unknown. There's still, but a lot of horror is about confronting things. It's about confronting fears, being put into those situations where you have to deal with these things.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Either they will destroy you or you will come out stronger.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, horror is divided into many subgenres. So you've got things like spatterpunk, which honestly I'm not a fan of, to be honest.
It can be fun.
I think you've... Yeah, I think if it's played off as a bit funny as well, maybe, I don't know. But generally, loses my interest.
I mean, Brain Dead with the zombies with the Flymo lawnmower will never not be funny.
No, I'd agree with that, actually. Yeah, that's fair.
Because it's hilarious. And the scene in Tucker, have you seen Tucker and Dale versus Evil?
No, I haven't.
You have to, because it's hilarious. There is a wood chipper scene in it, which just, it's just perfection. And I will never, ever stop laughing at that. So when it's funny, spatterpunk's funny, but I think when it's done seriously, it's like, okay, we're going into the realms of sadism here.
Yeah, and the whole torture porn thing, it's kind of like, I actually find myself getting quite bored because having spent years and years working in the NHS and seen some of the most gruesome things you can actually genuinely see, I'm kind of like, this isn't realistic.
No, exactly. And also there is this, I remember we watched the original Saw film and I thought, actually, that's quite clever for the original film. I thought but it's more of a thriller.
Yeah, it's got the psychological element, hasn't it?
It's got the psychological element. And then you watch the other ones and you're just like, I don't really want to see that. That's just that doesn't do anything for me at all, other than make me go, ew.
Yeah.
And I know some people kind of want that revulsion response, but I'm like, no, I don't want to be revolted. I want to be frightened, not revolted.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, looking at all these different genres, and personally, I love a good creature feature, and I also love a biomedical scientific horror. So they're some of my favourites. Like something that makes you think while it creeps you out, basically.
Definitely. Yeah, me too. I'm a big occult horror fan for that reason. Yeah. Occult horror, creature feature horror. We were watching The Meg the other day and my husband's there going, "What the hell is this?" And I'm like, "Shut up, this is the greatest thing ever invented. Be quiet." It's a giant shark. Shut up. Yeah, all of that. I love sci-fi horror. Really quite into sci-fi horror. And obviously gothic as well, and weird, Lovecraftian, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the more sort of the whimsy and the bleak as well, definitely.
Yes, definitely. We love a bit of bleakness.
So why might you, our listeners, wish to write horror? Well, you might want to just scare the shit out of your readers.
Which is fun.
That's legitimate, you know?
That is fun. Believe me, sitting there and that little evil little part, that little devil on your shoulder, he's sitting there and they're going, "Oh yeah, this will really freak them out." Yeah, the scene in Predator X when I wrote that, and it was like, okay, I've got a dead body, I've got to try and distract that thing. Okay, that's fun. Dead body, that thing, we can do it almost like a shark. Chum, fun. You know, that was literally just like, I just want to be disgusting, which was very fun. And that's legitimate, by the way, you know, just having fun. But yeah, there is a twisted sort of enjoyment in, this is really going to freak people out.
Yeah, I think there is also an element of writers tend to gravitate towards what interests them and also what they need to work out, you know, some of their own personal things.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, as a child, spent in perpetual fear due to extreme nightmares. And I think in confronting them, I think that was a big thing for me. It was like in confronting the things that scared me. I remember when I first started seriously watching horror films and reading horror novels and thinking, there is nothing on this page or on this screen that is as scary as what I can get up, what comes to me at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know.
Yeah,
it's like it was almost cathartic.
So this is one of my opinions. I'm going to ask you both, like, separately, what you sort of think. And but basically, I think personally, horror is most effective when it plays off other emotions rather than just using fear.
Definitely. I think that when you're looking at horror, it's not just a case of, like I said, it's got to be intriguing. You've got to intrigue people. Curiosity has to come in there as well. You have to have, love in terms of human emotional bonds is also very, very, very interesting in horror and has to be something that you have to explore, how these people interact and how they care for each other. Yeah, the book I'm writing at the moment, I've got, it's a family, basically, and the two main characters are sisters, and they have quite a fractious relationship. But the only way, you know, in confronting what's going on in this weird house that one of them has inherited, you know, they kind of come together and realise that actually, you know, we might have been avoiding each other for years and we might have been teasing each other and being vile to each other for a little, but actually when it comes down to it, we do actually love each other, and that we don't want to either one of us to be hurt.
Yeah,
you know. And I think also, having had two children, I had to be really careful with this, because some people get really freaked out by it, but it's things like when you explore that relationship when you're pregnant, people don't realize how much body horror there is in being pregnant.
Yeah.
Yeah, believe
midwife's daughter, so I probably grew up with a bit more knowledge.
And it's just like the things that your body does when you are pregnant. It's like, yeah, okay, people sit there and say that women are squeamish and, oh my god, they don't like blood. Hello. You know, I remember laying there and watching, you know, basically a whole another human turn over inside me.
Yeah,
you know, it's really sort of, that's kind of strange. But yeah, I think when it comes to the emotional side of it, it can't just be frightening. People have got to be more invested in things other than just being frightened, because quite frankly, that's when you just get the load of jump scares, and yeah, that's not very satisfying.
Yeah, it's cheap thrills. Yeah. Madeline?
I agree. I think the thing is that there's lots of flavours of fear, and fear isn't just something that comes to you in terms of a jump scare, but that fear is linked with anxiety and paranoia, fear for yourself and fear for other people, immediate fear, dread. There's lots and lots of different ways, and these are obviously inherently mixed with other emotions. And personally, I think that something that horror the kind of horror that I sort of pick up, because I'm not a big horror fan, but I do like the gothic, is actually more about the exploration of trauma.
Yeah.
And that there is obviously fear linked with that, and it's the fear of confronting those kinds of things. And that's also, I think, where a lot of the catharsis can really come into it. But just having repetitive jump scares, that's triggering your sort of your immediate anxiety. And you can obviously use other things to sort of create tension and things like that. But ultimately, it starts to get a little bit boring. And as we've said earlier on, at the heart of horror is that exploration of humanity. And in order to really hit at the core of a person, you've got to understand what they fear. And what they fear isn't always the immediate jump scare, oh, something's coming out to get me, but other things as well. And that is linked very much with other emotions.
Definitely. And also, if we didn't have other ties to other people, then in all honesty, apart from our own immediate survival, what is there to be frightened of? You have to have people around you in order to, the layers of, it's the layers of fear, the layers of anxieties, the layers of things that make us go, oh my God, what happens if this happens? I mean, look at what's going on in the world today with the whole COVID thing. I'm not that scared of catching it myself, but I am very frightened of bringing it home. Because I've got vulnerable family members.
It's funny, not COVID, it's funny how you say, I had one of my characters on something that has not been published pop up at one point and say to another character quite darkly, all fear is ultimately fear of death. And, you know, the other character was like, well, that's stupid. I'm not actually afraid of dying. And this character just said it, just came out with, no, you are. You might be afraid of the death of a relationship or the death of a family member, but all of it is ultimately the fear of something ending.
Yeah, it is about that whole thing about things ending. I mean, that's why they talk about us living in fearful times at the moment, because it really does feel that we are in this point of flux where things are ending. Things that we take for granted as being, as I was saying earlier on about, like the nature of reality. Our reality is, and I don't mean in terms of physics reality, I mean in terms of like of the way we live our lives.
Social reality.
Yeah, our social reality. Yeah, it's kind of breaking down. And new things, and people are quite fearful. And I think that's why we're getting a lot of polarisation. A lot of people being very shouty on the internet and things like that. And I think it is people broadcasting their fear.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Okay, so how horror can influence other genres. We've touched on this a little bit, but I think that if you add a dash of horror to your fantasy, sci-fi, contemporary, your romance even, you can make the entire thing sharper. So as we were talking about fear and its relationship to other emotions, by adding fear, a fearful element, a horrific element to your book, you can actually make all the other elements sort of stand out more starkly in relief.
Yeah. Look at it from the point of view of, you can have a lovely, beautiful, light romance, but you've got to have that fear that they might break up.
They might not get together.
Something might stop them, or that something they've wanted together might not happen. I mean, one of, again, going back to being pregnant, you don't know fear. I've never felt fear until my baby stopped moving.
Yeah.
Happy, lovely, pregnant, happy time until you can't feel them. And oh my God, you are down, I mean, especially with your first one, you are down at maternity hospital. Scan me, please scan me, just to make sure everything's okay. So it can be all lovely and fluffy and happy and great, but there is all, there is going to be that whole thing, that note of tension. How long is this going to last? Is it going to last? Is it ever going to be what I think it's going to be? So you can sort of play around with these different things. Horror comedy is a great marriage.
You make definitely.
Things, because let's face it, we all like to laugh at things we shouldn't.
Have you ever read or even watched the film of Warm Bodies by Isaac Marion?
I have.
And even the book. The book is quite a lot darker than the film. The film, they play it off a bit more for laughs, yeah. But both of them are really, really funny.
I know. You sit there sometimes and you're like, I shouldn't be laughing at this, but I will. It's like Robert Rankin. He's a great one for that.
Yeah.
Because obviously he's an absurdist as well. But when some of the stuff he... One of my favourite jokes was from Snuff Fiction, when they had the auto-erotic asphyxiation magazine called Gagging For It.
Oh,
and that slayed me. It was just a really sort of tight... It's really dark, but it's really funny. And I love that. And you look at things like... Have you ever read any of Charles Stross's novels, like The Atrocity Archives and his laundry novels?
No, I haven't.
Oh, they're well worth it. They're like Lovecraftian horrors, but they are really funny as well. And it just works. It's almost like there's like pathos in this. You know, he's the main character in that is basically a civil servant.
Yeah.
Trying to stop Lovecraftian monstrosities from getting into the world. And if you've ever worked for the civil service, you'll just sit there and you'll be like, oh my God, yeah, I get this. This is actually really, this is what it's, people are going, oh, he's exaggerating. And you're thinking, no, he's not. I've worked for the civil service. I know he's not exaggerating at all. You know, You can't go and defeat that eldritch horror until you filled out 16 forms in triplicate. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Okay, I'm going to have to read those.
They're
now,
very, very funny. And I really, but they are very, very dark. Yeah, they are incredibly dark, but they're very, very funny as well. So yeah, there's lots of crossover, and like it's that. If everything was nice all the time, there would be no spice to life.
Well, there'd be no nice because there'd be no contrast.
Because you have no contrast, exactly. You've got to like, say rough with the smooth. You've got to take one with the other, don't you?
Yeah,
but it's also the fact that without it, there's no sense of excitement. Nice is nice, but it's not exciting. And there's, you know, the fear comes with a thrill of excitement, anticipation. People do things to get a high and to have fear induced all the time, from going on a roller coaster, hell, even being on a swing in some ways.
Absolutely.
It's actually a tiny little kernel of fear which makes that pleasurable.
And it's also that whole thing, because you know, like going on a swing or whatever, you know it's ultimately safe.
Probably.
As well. You know, it's that whole thing of I'm taking a risk, but it's kind of a safe risk.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm not going to get eaten by crocodiles because I've gone on a swing. But it invokes that same sort of spike of, woo, within you. You know, it's like small children. It's quite funny when you watch them going on to things like swings. What? Look at me, mummy. Look at me, mummy. And you're thinking they're swinging away and they're feeling that wonderful thrill. And as a mother, you've got this pit of dread in your stomach because you're like, you're going to come off, you're going to break your arm. Please don't do that. But yeah, but you have to let them do it, because again, this exploration of risk and of thrill. I mean, I watch those videos. I mean, I don't watch them very often because I don't really like heights. But you see those videos of those mad people that climb buildings.
Mm. Yeah.
Have you seen the ones they go to the top of, like, they're normally Russian for some reason, and there they are dancing around on the top of incredibly tall buildings. And I must admit, I sit there and watch them and think, why?
Yeah, I used to cliff climb.
Oh, why?
Because, see, this is the thing. People ask me that. It was one of those things where, along with martial arts competitions, my mum said, I don't want to know you've done it until you've come back and you're safe, kind of thing. So I never used to tell her that I was competing or whatever. I used to just say, oh, yeah, I competed last weekend. I've got a black eye now, whatever.
Yeah.
And cliff climbing, my mum is absolutely petrified of heights. I love heights.
I'm not a fan.
The one time my mum wasn't frightened of heights was when she was pregnant with me, and she climbed all the way to the top of the Blackpool Tower.
Oh, crikey.
So go figure, there's something weird going on there.
There is something weird going on there. And like I said, before, pregnancy might make you do weird things.
Yeah, but the reason I used to do it was it's the ultimate high. I mean, I know that... I'm not explaining that.
My father is he used to be in fire brigade, and down in Pompey, down here in Portsmouth, when they opened up the Spinnaker Tower, it's supposed to be modelled on it was supposed to look like a sail, and it kind of looks like a one in Dubai, but it's not. It's Portsmouth's version of it, bless it. But it's very tall, it's very big. And I kind of stand at the bottom of it and think, no, nope, I don't like that, I'm not going up there. And then they say it's got a glass floor, and I'm like, no, I really am not going up there. But my father, obviously being in the fire brigade, he was up high on all different kinds of things. And when it was first opened, they were going to be doing, somebody was going to do a base jump off it. Yeah. And
yeah, I'm not sure I'd do that.
No, somebody did a base jump. It's not quite the top. There's a little bit that you can get into. And it, as he was telling me the story, I could feel my anxiety rising. And he said that they took him to the place where the bloke was going to do the jumping. And he said it's literally like this tiny little almost step that you kind of just go out the side of the tower onto. And he said, yeah, it's like, I don't know how many 100 feet up it is or whatever. But I said, what, you could fall. He went, yeah. He said, but that's the fun. So the fact that you could fall, that's part of it. And he said, I interpret that sort of swooping feeling as complete fear. Whereas he interprets that swooping woof feeling as exhilaration.
Yeah, and it is like that. You're 40 feet up a cliff face and you've just got one other person with you and they're belaying the rope and it's just kind of like, okay, if I misjudge this next move, I could just come off the cliff.
Yeah.
And it's kind of getting to the top and the endorphin rush is amazing.
I know.
It's even better than a fight. And I've had some really, really, obviously professional fights.
Yeah.
Had some really good professional fights.
Not brawling outside the pub on the other Saturday night.
No. It's like, I'm not quite that much of an adrenaline junkie.
Come here, you.
But So anyway, all three of us have written non-horror books as well as other horror. But let's look at how we've added horror to our non-horror books. I'm going to pick on Madeline first because I want to talk about the Corrigans, which actually genuinely freaked me out.
Okay. So one aspect of horror that I really like is, and some people might have noticed, that I'm super, super into fairies. This may come as a shock to some of you.
It's
not going to come as a shock to anyone who listens to this podcast.
But fairies are scary. I'm sorry, they are.
They are. They really are. And I loved that as a child. I just thought there was something so deliciously frightening about them. And obviously, they're very linked with the natural world. And when I was little, we moved around a lot. And there were definitely places that we would go and visit where you got that real sense of just how dangerous the natural world really is, whilst being beautiful. And I wanted to do the Corrigans in such a way that you mix that idea of something which is inherently beautiful, but also basically screams wrongness.
I love that.
And I kind of also wanted to kind of, I really wanted to trigger that uncanniness to them as well. So I just thought, and I really want them to be typical fae, like scary sort of fae, the kinds of things you don't want to encounter. Because obviously you meet fae or Mara before that, and she's powerful and she's cool, but she's a Katshi. And she's actually relatively sensible, quite a nice person, and I thought, and now I really have to introduce the other side of it too. And so we have these Corrigans, and I really wanted to go into the full folk horror with them.
Folk horror is the best, though.
It is. And I think also with the Corrigans, I wanted to trigger something very particular in people, which is that sense of unease when you look at something which isn't that far away from you, because the Corrigans were a product of human interference. Mm. They were made that way. They're kind of the personification of vengeance, and they're very sort of self-centered at this point, and they didn't used to be. That was their whole thing, was that they actually used to be serving individuals, which were twisted that way. So there's an element of the Corrigans which is that they could be us, that they could be you, that they are the monsters that we created. And it's like a mirror image. The Corrigans, there's a weird sense of mirrors with the Corrigans where you almost feel like you could just see one in the mirror kind of staring back at you. Mm. They're very watery, they're not quite tangible. They're dream-esque. So that's really where I went with the Corrigans. So I think there are two main real bodies of horror in the Hamartia cycle. One is definitely the Corrigans, who are very nasty. The other one is just de Giles, but that's really, that's psychological and sort of...
No. Yeah. That is full on body horror.
That was quite psychological and body someone horror. Else. Yeah.
And then regurgitating them.
Okay, no, okay, that's yeah, all right, okay, I'll give you that.
Thank you.
And probably that's because that's the kind of horror that I'm terrified of, and de Giles needs to be the worst person that I've ever written, so that was why I made him as terrifying as possible for me.
Yeah. So with Fugly, I think it was that realization that once you remove the brakes of having the internet there, yeah, and considering it like an extension of your own mind and you can say and think whatever you want, it was how deep that well goes,
yeah,
for me with Hug Fugly.
I know, it was just a case of, right, we're not going to hold back, although I did kind of hold back because there were obviously certain parts of it that I wasn't going to go down, but it was the bit
I think you embrace the possibility, yes, of those things. I mean, we're talking a bit obliquely.
Yes,
but
obviously.
If you think of some of the sites that, I mean, you can find anything on the internet,
exactly,
if you really want to. You're like three clicks away from it.
It really, that does, it's that whole thing of it's really scary, but also it's also really intriguing. You know, it's like when you hear about something horrific on the news and you're like, oh, that's terrible, but I've got to read this article all about it because, you know, it's horrific and I want to know the details. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And I think one of the worst things that Beth, yeah, obviously the bit where she vicariously helps break up that guy's marriage. And yeah, she thinks it's a game. Because it's on the internet. She thinks it's a game. She doesn't realise that actually, it's not until much later on that she realises that, oh, that's actually somebody's life. That's not me just mucking about. This isn't just about me making me feel better. And it is that once you've got a screen in front of you, you know, you can turn into the monster. And it is, again, it's that what Madeline was saying about mirrors. It's holding up that mirror to her and to the reader and saying, how far have you gone? How far will you go to get those likes, to get those clicks, to get that attention that you so obviously crave?
That little surge of power. Yeah. You know, obviously being a teenage girl, a lot of that is about experimenting with power.
Exactly, so. About finding out where you fit in this world. And also there's the whole thing of, obviously, Beth herself has got quite severe issues of self-esteem and quite severe issues with, you know, she really doesn't know where she fits in the world. And it's meeting Tori, you know, I think the whole thing with Tori was because we don't know who she was. We don't know who that person
was. We never know. Nope. I can't believe you did that.
No, I'm sorry. Do you know why I did that? Because I turned around to some of my kids that I teach and I said, what's scarier? I said, you're talking to somebody on the internet and they're egging you on to do, like, worse things in terms of trolling. I said, is it scarier that you do know who they are or that you don't know who they are? And they unanimously turned around and said that we don't know who they are, because they said it could be the person sitting next to me and I'd never know.
Yeah, it could be your own teacher.
It could be anyone. It could be your next door neighbor. It could be the nice, you know, it could literally be anyone. And that was part of the message as well. It was, you know, you trust these people on the net, but you don't know who they are. You haven't got a clue. And also, you don't know what they know about you, because there are very clever people out there that can work out. Yeah, I remember I used to be a moderator on a big Tomb Raider website. And, you know, through IP addresses, I could find out exactly where you lived.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's scary. I still have that old 90s, sort of late 90s, early 2000s thing of, you know, everything must be anonymous. You don't know. Because it really was like, you know, you never gave out personal information on the internet, ever. You know, it was, you were literally this character on the net when it first came around. And now I do look at young people and I look at what they're sharing. And I'm thinking, please don't do that. because that can be used against you, and there are people out there who will do that.
Yeah, definitely. Whether it's an emotional rant or...
or whatever.
Sort of, oh, look, here's a picture of my house, kind of thing.
Exactly. It could be anything. And it is really, really worrying. I remember a little while ago, my daughters are really into Final Fantasy VII at the moment. And my youngest loves to dress up as Aerith. And she was desperate. And my eldest just dresses up as Tifa. And they wanted me to take photographs off of me. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll take some photographs off you. And my youngest was like, oh, that's... put them on your Twitter so people can see them. And I got a picture of my youngest with, she had her hair covering her face. So I was like, okay, you can't see her face. But my eldest was like, put mine on there too. I said, I can't, darling. And she said, why not? I look just like Tifa. I said, yeah, and that's the problem. Because Tifa wears a crop top and a miniskirt. And she's 11. That's fine at home when we're mucking about and we're dressing up and we're being silly. There's no way that's going on the internet. Because you have absolutely no idea who's going to get hold of that information and what they're going to do with it. And that is frightening.
Yeah, definitely. You know, as you said, there's a lot of horror in real life.
There really is a lot of horror in real life. You don't have to create ghosts and ghouls to find horror. There's the simple horror of the guy who gropes Beth on the bus. You know, it's like most of us have been in that situation at some point in our lives and have felt that paralysing fear when you realise that somebody has just completely encroached in your space, has absolutely no respect for you whatsoever in terms of consent. And they're, you know, it's horrible, especially as a woman. You know, you feel it and you think, and there are people all around me, and it happened to me on a train. And it's just, it's petrifying. You know, and so it's all, and I think that's the thing with Fugly. It's not this one big element of horror. It's the little horrors that build up to the point when I think it's the pizza night scene, which I definitely cried from the beginning to the end of writing that.
It is an incredibly affecting scene. I'm sorry to sort of derail this. I'm just going to segue us over into the wrap-up section, because we've actually been talking
about it. I know, I just realised that.
That's amazing. Okay, so let's just have a look as we sort of wind the episode up at basically horror and people.
Yeah.
And obviously most horror, as we've discussed, works because it's about the characters, not about the monster, whatever the monster might be.
Mm.
Horror, I think, is a great way of stress testing your characters. It's that idea that you've never really met someone until you've seen them dealing with fear.
I think it always makes me think of Unveiled whenever I sort of think about horror and sort of the horror of people. And I think about Unveiled particularly because it had such a profound effect when I first read it, I Belong to the Earth. Because the thing with I Belong to the Earth, which really struck emotionally for me, was this family dynamic that was happening. And it was through the horror of all of the events that this family dynamic sort of was pushed forward. And I know you did that on purpose at the same time. but it was just... it was fantastic for me, and it really kind of brought out the relationship between horror and people, and how people can be their own sort of monsters. Because, you know, there were moments later on as well where the thing Emmeline feared was herself, and not the big bad, and there was that whole kind of veering between, you know, am I becoming a monster, or, you know, is there something else? And then obviously, and I don't want to give too many spoilers, you do flat out, Jules, have one book where, again, it's that question of what's the real monster here? Is, you know, is it supernatural or is it something else?
Yeah, I was always fascinated by that. I'm going to misquote this now, but that Nietzsche quote, you know,
but the abyss.
They who fight monsters must be careful not to become the monster. And if you look into the abyss looks back, etc.
Yeah.
And I've got a feeling that might have like peopled that entire series with characters who are on the verge of actually taking that one step too far down the dark path kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and horror does allow you to examine the darkest creases of the human soul. By extension, your own psyche, really.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I was doing when I was writing Fugly as well. You know, it was like, I was never going to tell you a nice bedtime story. Come on, let's face it. And it was, and I, people said to me, who's the antagonist? And it's like, she's the same one as the protagonist. It's the same character. Yeah,
she's literally her own worst enemy.
Yeah, she really
enemy,
is. It's a case of, you know, Tori, people could say Tori's the antagonist, but she's not really, because let's face it, she's not actually there. At one point, it was almost going to be a Fight Club scenario where she wasn't even real. But we decided that, no, that's Fight Club and that's been done. Come on. And so, but it was that whole thing of, Beth is her own worst enemy, and she really is not only, she is quite far down that road to becoming that monster. And it is the fact that, you know, to go into the whole human relationships thing, the thing that pulls her out of it is the fact that she is able to form relationships with other people.
Yeah, definitely. You know? Okay, so two thoughts to finalise on horror, and you know, I think they sort of sit next to each other, but they're not exactly the same thing. One is that horror shows you that evil can be fought.
Yeah.
The other is that, you know, horror is also the catharsis of the inevitable. So we were talking about The Thing earlier, and the fact that that doesn't have a happy ending.
No, I love it.
In fact, that might be just about to all start again. But there's something sort of innately comforting about the idea that we're all heading for that final destination and together at some point.
We may as well just sit in the snow and drink whiskey. You know?
So that there is something a bit comforting about bleakness, just as there's something comforting about the idea that we can fight the monsters we create.
Well, it's Terry Pratchett. Was it Terry Pratchett who said about that? I can't remember. Was it Stephen King who said something about monsters? Yeah, the whole point of it's not the fact that there are monsters, it's the fact that you can fight them and defeat them.
Yeah.
I think it might be Stephen King who said that. But it's something along those lines, and it's very, very true. Yeah, and that monster may not be, you know, a scary clown or an axe-wielding maniac or a dragon or whatever. It may not be those things. It might be the fact that you've got a test tomorrow, or the fact that, you know, you've got to go and do something you really don't want to do tomorrow. But they may not be, you know, the supernatural, big, scary monsters that inhabit our entertainment, but these are our own personal, quiet little fears. And they are no less scary.
Yeah, it's the idea that fleer? Fleer is like fear, except it's a bit sort of edgier.
Yeah.
It has wings. fear is a flavour of life.
Yes.
And it is neither negative nor positive. It's just part of the experience. To kind of take it away is to actually lose a very vital ingredient in how we also appreciate things. And it's about sort of living with fear, and it's sort of accepting that fear is something that we will all experience. And that's not actually something to be, oddly enough, afraid of.
It's that whole thing is, without fear, you know, would we really value anything? Because we value things because we fear losing them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's wrap this up by just briefly giving some of our favourite horror moments.
Oh, there are a lot of them.
All right, narrow it down to two.
Two.
Some of your
first
narrow it down
one,
to two.
Not a book, not a book, not a film, but a game. Okay, you both might have seen me talking about this actually on the internet recently, because I did a thread on it. In the very first Tomb Raider game, first coming into Egypt, honestly, you read it, bloody evil.
I read it.
You know the bit I mean. And it plays. You have learned by this point. I mean, this is an old game, okay? It came out in 1996. It's old. I absolutely adore it. But all the way through this game, you are built up that there are a certain set of rules, okay, and that you will come across enemies, but not many. You know, it is an eerie game, but you know there's danger. And you get to this point in this game where you go to Egypt, and it's beautiful. After the dankness of the sewers and things, it is absolutely beautiful. It's orange and it's yellow and and you're thinking, you see a sphinx in front of you, and you're like, oh, I really want to explore that sphinx. That is gorgeous. I want to jump all over that. And then this thing, this white thing, just comes out from around the back, and you think, right, I know, I've learned my lesson. I'll find a place of high ground and I'll shoot it. And then once I've shot it, I will go and find out what this thing is. So you stand there and you shoot it, and it runs around. You're like, gosh, it looks big and it looks a bit scary and it moves a bit too fast for me to really get a good grip of it, past the fact that 90s graphics. And then when you kill it, it explodes. And you're like, I don't know what that was. I have no idea what is that? What does it do? And I'm petrified. Just to this day, even after playing that game, I go, how many times those things, with that bloody noise they make, you'll be in the middle of you'll be walking around this beautiful sandy area and you'll hear thump, thump, thump. And it's just like someone stuck, like a car battery into the base of my spine. Because that's it, I'm petrified now, I can't deal with life. That's one of them, then. Bloody mummies. I love them, though. I absolutely love them. And if you look up for pictures of them on the internet and find the original ones, they do look like they've been made out of egg boxes. I am aware of that. But that doesn't matter. They're still really scary. That one. The other one is from the beginning of the book of The House of Leaves, which I have never read a book where I had no idea why I was so scared. I just read it.
It's really weird and mind-bending.
It is such a strange book. And I just read, and I just remember reading this, and I'm thinking, and it was the scene at the beginning. It was where he was the five and a half minute hallway, I think he calls it. And it's like a book within a book within a film within something else, isn't it? It's really odd. And the main character is horrible. Johnny Truant is such a horrible character, and you're just like, well, I really don't like him, but what, I feel compelled to read this. And it's the bit where they show the video, and they describe how the guy who shot the film shows the outside of the house, and then one continuous shot brings the camera in and then shows that there's a door and opens it up, and there's a corridor that goes into what shouldn't be there. And it was just like, that is everything for me in horror. It's like, it's mysterious, it shouldn't be there, it shouldn't exist, I need to know what's going on. And that, I just read that. I mean, it's a chunk of a book as well. And I sat there and I remember reading the whole thing, and my knuckles were white where I was gripping it so hard. It's just, and all the way through you're like, there's no monster, there's nothing to blame. It is just what it is. And it's petrifying. Absolutely terrifies me.
I'm weird in the sense of the ones that affect me seem to be more about existential angst. So I'm going to mention a film that people are going to go, oh, that's not horror, that's sci-fi. But I feel there's a strong horror component. And that's 12 Monkeys.
Love that film.
And I love it. And for years I also hated it because of the unresolved feeling to the ending. It was only when Alan said, yeah, but hang on, he's just had that conversation with the woman, he's clearly broken the cycle at the end. But it was the sheer Sisyphean hopelessness of constantly going back through time to try and track this virus and stop it all from happening, and yet coming back to find, no, you're still in this post-apocalyptic, post sort of human pandemic wasteland.
He ate a spider as well, and that's always scary.
Yeah, so I mean that that really played on me.
Love that.
And then it was there's lots of other, there's things like the entire first Alien movie.
Oh,
for
it's
example,
a masterclass, isn't it?
Tension really well. But the one that I think I'll mention is from when I was 12 and I read Robin Jarvis's The Whitby Witches, which may not actually be that scary for people now compared to what we now sort of give sort of pre-teens to read, but at the time it was playing into that idea of, you know, when you're a child and you're in the dark and you're thinking there's something there, and you know logically there isn't anything there, but eventually you get up the courage to check and there's nothing there. And it was this idea of Jennet sort of getting up and it's like, I can hear, she thinks she's heard this huge black hound, the Bargeist, and she's like, well, I'm going to look out the window and there's going to be nothing there. There's going to be nothing there. And she goes to the window and there's nothing there. And then a huge black shape comes down the alleyway all the way to the doorstep of the house. And she's there at the window, frozen in fear. And it looks up at her with these red eyes. And it doesn't sound scary when I'm talking about it, but it's just the it was the way it played on that whole sort of, your check, there's nothing there, the world is as you know it. And it's
that's
completely
it.
Turned
again,
on
it's
its
that
head.
Whole thing of, we cannot rely on our what our eyes are telling us. You cannot rely on that reality.
I think for me, Alien aside, I'm not going to mention Alien just because I was way too young to be watching that movie.
I think we were all too young when we first saw that movie.
My dad was just like, this is fine. He's like, we were like, this is an 18. And he's just there like, yeah, but this is an 18 from back then. You'll be fine now. I wasn't. It was also the same when we went to see The Woman in Black, and it was like, yeah, it'll be fine. I really wasn't. But two books which really stuck with me in terms of horror that sort of chilled me in a way that I didn't necessarily expect. The first one was a book called The Icarus Girl by Helen Oyeyemi, which I hope I'm saying right. And in this book, there is this description that one of the characters draws this woman who's just called the long-armed woman, and it's just this woman who has these her arms are very disproportionate to the rest of her body. And there was something about, at one point, one of them dreams about this woman with the long arms, and I remember just sitting up bolt right in bed, looking at my bathroom doorway, waiting for her to step out of the bathroom. To maul me with these insanely long arms. And I have no idea why she terrified me so much, but it was just, the whole book is very creepy and it's actually well worth a read. But yeah, I remember that really struck me and I was like, oh God. And then the other one was Stephen King, The Pet Sematary.
Good old Pet Sematary.
Yeah, which has lots and lots of sort of very frightening bits. One of the really creepy things is that dream sequence where the father thinks that he has actually saved his son.
Yeah.
And then he wakes up and he hasn't. And there's lots of bits and bobs in The Pet Sematary, which just kind of sends you shivering. And it's never really explained why it's all occurring, but...
Yeah, it's the mixture of grief, actually, that makes the horror that much worse there.
It really does. It's very tangible. And it's also the fact that, you know, he's brought the cat back and he knows the cat is wrong.
And but that love for his son still compels him.
Yeah, it still compels him. And it's just the fact that he knows that it's going to go wrong. He has no idea how wrong it's going to go. But he's being compelled to do it.
He's
going to
do it anyway.
For me, it's terrifying.
It's when he goes into the graveyard to dig his son back up. That did me in.
Oh, God,
Because I read it.
There's a bit, he also sees a Wendigo,
he does.
At one point as well.
But it's that scene did me in, because I read it obviously when I was younger, but then I read it again. I think, don't read it when you've had your own children. My children were quite young, and I just remember reading it going, this has got a whole new layer of horror to it now, because I'm like, I can imagine. I remember talking about, especially also the whole thing about the woman with the long arms in the bathroom. I remember when I just had my first daughter, and you know, you don't get much sleep and you actually do start thinking you're going a little bit mad. And I remember I was feeding her in the early hours of the morning, so it's all dark. And I was absolutely convinced, and I do not know why, but I was absolutely convinced that there was someone standing on the landing watching us. And I had no idea, and I thought it was an old man. There was nothing there, but I was convinced that an old man was standing on the hallway, standing on the landing, watching me feed my baby. And that's it terrifying. Was absolutely petrifying. And I don't know why that ever even came into my head. But it was there, and I would sit there and I would be there feeding her and with one eye on the doorway, just waiting for like a pair of some fingers to like come around the door frame or something. Yeah.
My mother, she watched The Woman in Black. My father took her to see the play when she was pregnant with my brother. And I just thought that, and she was like, this was a poor decision.
That was a poor decision.
Anyway, we've overrun
a little bit.
But it was a big topic.
Yeah.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And unsurprisingly, we will be recommending Fugly.
Thank you.
Which we've probably covered a lot of what the book is roughly about, and we don't want to give spoilers.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because you're like, but just to warn people, you know, it's not the feel-good hit of the summer.
No. But you know, there's plenty of sort of the psychological horror and the elements of looking at the dark scrapings of the human mind there. So you might like that book.
Yeah, but at the end of it all, there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. And on that note, we will say thank you very much for coming to join us, Claire. It's been lovely to have you
here. Thank you for having me, letting me ramble.
And we hope that all of our listeners are having a really nice weekend and really enjoy Halloween, if you're celebrating it, Samhain, if you're celebrating it, or just the general good autumn vibes.
Happy Halloween!
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.